Hello, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Unfortunately, Peter cannot be with us this morning because he has to go build an ark.
I'm just joking.
Yeah,
we hope that wherever you are, there's some kind of a middle ground between the torrential rainfall we're getting in the northeastern United States
and these horrible droughts
and bushfires in Colorado and California. Anyway, so wherever you are, we hope you're having fun and you're ready for another interesting On the Menu program this morning. And we've got three very different views of the universe of the culinary world today.
Is that what that is?
I think so, yeah. Well, first of all, a different place to have your garden and grow things.
Secondly,
different flavors. Flavors of a native Indian superimposed onto the cuisine of 25 other regions around the world.
Now, wait a minute. It's not a native Indian. I mean, if you say native Indian, people think of Native Americans.
You're
talking about East Indians.
Somebody from East India, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay.
And then third up, we have an expert. You will be in the presence of an expert at the Culinary Institute of America, who knows all about how to cook Mediterranean.
Right.
And then finally, we're inching into a controversy over who invented kettle chips and where they should be produced in the world, and that's right at the end of the program. But without further ado, let's get on with today's program. Very, very clever title for this book, Eat Up.
I knew this book was going to come up, and that's Eat Up. That's a bad pun, isn't it? Well, we're talking to Lauren Mandel, who is a landscape architect from Philadelphia, who's done an incredible job. I would say not only is the first published comprehensive book on rooftop gardening, but it is also a handbook on how to go about it. Lauren, is that how you designed it?
Yes. Like you said, there's never been a book written about rooftop agriculture. There's never been a full-length book. And so as first book about rooftop agriculture, I felt the obligation to be as comprehensive as possible and try to target a rather wide audience of people who are interested in growing food on rooftops, everyone from homeowners to restaurateurs and entrepreneurs to city planners.
Well, I would say that your book is enabling. At the same time, it presents some issues which I think might give people pause to consider in depth more the issues that they're facing with this rooftop gardening. It's just you don't stick a pot of cucumbers on your roof.
Right. One of my objectives to writing this book was to introduce people to all of the different considerations involved in growing food on rooftops before they get started. A lot of things that might come up once you're underway that are best thought through beforehand. So as a designer, the place where I usually come in is during design, so before construction takes place. And I wanted to convey to readers the importance of thinking everything through before you get started in order to maximize your chance of success.
Yeah, now you make a distinction between rooftop garden and a rooftop farm.
Yes, that's right. And I should preface my response now by saying that there is not full agreement amongst professionals about this distinction between gardening and farming in general. And so early on in my book, I take a sort of stance on the matter and take into consideration what a lot of folks are saying. And the perspective that the book takes is really that the distinction between gardening and farming is that farming is commercial and gardening is not. And so throughout the book, I talk about rooftop gardening as something that involves food that is produced for self-consumption, for gifting, for charity. And then rooftop farming takes into consideration the commercial aspects of the endeavor. So this is food that you're growing specifically for sale. And that could be sale within your own restaurant below the farm, or it could be sale to supermarkets around the city. And then also I do talk about a third perspective in the book, which is the rooftop agriculture industry. And this is sort of a neighborhood-wide or city-wide view of rooftop agriculture, and it takes into consideration what's necessary to make rooftop agriculture possible at a large scale.
Right.
And here you talk about limitations on of various construction codes and other regulations and that kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. And that applies a little bit to gardening, but more to large-scale, medium-scale operations. So it is very important before you get started to make sure that you understand the building codes and the zoning codes in your area to make sure that what you're doing is completely legal.
Yeah, I thought that section was really very amusing about the different cities and what was allowed.
Yes, it does vary city by city. And so if you grew up in one city and you move to another and think that you know the building codes, you better take a closer look at what's actually written for that particular city that you're living in.
Now, let me be simplistic for a second. Obviously, this is Peter speaking. In general, if what you're growing on your roof is plants, then would I be right in saying that you're probably not really seriously affected by regulations? It's when you start introducing animals that it gets more complicated.
Oh, well, certainly there are regulations for animals in city. But when you're growing plants, there's other things that you need to look out for, such as what's required by the building code in your city with regards to accessing the roof regularly. So oftentimes in a city, you'll be permitted to climb up onto the roof once or twice a year. But if you're going up regularly, then you have to take certain precautions. So there have to be specific architectural features that are in place in order to ensure that your access, your regular access, is done safely and according to the law. So things such as whether you can access by a ladder or whether it's required that you have something called a head house, which is essentially a staircase that leads all the way up to the roof with a door at the top. Something else that you have to consider is the local building codes that tell you how tall the wall or fence that surrounds your roof has to be so you don't accidentally fall over the side. These are all things that are specified by the building code, and it's important to keep in mind that the reason why these codes exist is to protect people's safety.
So even if you just want to put a few plants in pots, you still really need to get yourself informed about what's required.
Exactly, and my book goes through basics for home gardeners as well as professionals.
Back in the day, as they say now, the most rooftop gardening that I was aware of was sticking some marijuana plants on the roof.
Oh, dear. I hope the statute...
Not me. I never did that.
I hope the statute of limitations has expired. We did know one leading Philadelphian who had a pool on his rooftop, and that was surrounded by appropriate vegetation.
Yes, that was Jack.
He's dead, so the statute of limitations has expired on him, too.
Now, you have, I thought it was fascinating, this whole range of types. You go through container gardening, raised bed production, row farming, hydroponics, and those are all kind of obvious, I guess, except for hydroponics. But then you do aeroponics, aquaponics, which I don't know how that differs from hydro, but you have to tell us. Aquaculture, again. Then you go into livestock farming, dairy farming, orchard production, vineyard production, and apiculture, which is very popular where we live, actually.
Just in case, listeners, you're not as well-informed as Anne is, that means bees.
Oh, bees, right. But it never occurred to me that most places would accommodate goats on the roof.
There are a few places around North America, and I should say that North America is the focus of my book. There is rooftop agriculture going on in other parts of the world, but I was taking a look at the stuff that's going on closer to home. But, yeah, there are a few places that have goats on the roof, believe it or not.
And they train the lead goat. They train that goat not to jump off, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
It's like the weather. What do you call the sheep? The weather something, W-E-T-H-E-R, that they get so they don't jump the fence, or that they do jump the fence. I can't remember which it is, with sheep.
Oh, well, this particular roof that I think you're talking about, which is in the Midwest on top of a restaurant, has a sod roof, and the goats were brought up initially in order to mow the lawn,
right,
believe it or not. And then like you said, they were trained to not jump off the roof. And there's no parapet or anything up there. They stay up there because of their training.
Well, there is this...
How on earth do you train a goat not to jump off a roof?
Well, they
That's
train,
a very good question.
They train the sheep that way. Ask John Jamison about the weather bell or whatever it's called.
You have to talk to them in sheep language or goat language?
But, you know, chickens are becoming increasingly popular on roofs, and there are many roofs that have bees in order to fertilize the crops.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense.
At least one that I can think of that has rabbits on the roof, and what they do is they collect the manure from the rabbits in order to fertilize their crops, which is a pretty good way to fertilize if you're able to.
Yeah, and they generally discourage roosters.
I'm sorry, they discourage what?
Roosters.
Roosters, yes. In most cities, it is illegal to have a rooster within the city because of the noise that they can create.
Well, Peter pointed out earlier that it's kind of silly to think that would make any difference in a busy New York neighborhood.
Yeah, so you're better off with hens. Stick to the ladies.
You know, Robert, you were talking about the Mott's apple cider guy.
Oh, yeah, we did hear once a member of the Mott family, which makes apple juice, I guess. That he actually had an urban farm. My sense was that it was actually in his apartment, and he kept cows and things like that. And we knew someone who lived on floors below him who was somewhat worried about it. But I guess if you're a Mott apple juice heir, then you can do pretty much anything you please.
Is there an echo?
That must be
yes,
Scott.
I think so. And it's so interesting to see how many different ways people are growing food in cities. It's really unbelievable. So the list that you mentioned earlier of all the different methods that people are using to grow food on roofs, pretty extensive. And I would say that the most common method for growing food on roofs in North America is container gardening, raised bed production, row farming, and hydroponics, which is usually done in a greenhouse in North America.
Okay, so by hydroponic, you mean artificially ripened, I guess.
Right, so hydroponics is growing plants, soil-less environment. So in place of soil, you would use a substrate like rock wool or some other kind of material that involves no soil, and then that material and the roots of the plant are inundated with water that's flowing past them at all times, and the water is filled with nutrients, so it's really a nutrient solution. And so you're able to provide the plants with exactly the nutrients that they need in an enclosed, regulated sort of environment where the temperature and all the climatic features are very much controlled.
One thing you mentioned, it's very important, and I'm sure most people wouldn't instinctively think of this, is that you're adding a lot of weight to a part of the roof that's really designed to stop the rain and other climate from coming in. But by the time you put heavy rain barrels and soil and things like this up there, you are putting a strain on the roof. So you'd better have someone help you to make sure that you've engineered it properly.
Exactly. And this is one of the very first things that anyone should do when they're thinking about growing food on a roof, is you need to speak with a structural engineer to make sure that your roof is able to support exactly the loads that you plan on putting on it. So this is sort of interesting, because what this also means is before you get started, you really need to know what you plan on putting on top, because when your structural engineer comes, he or she will be able to tell you exactly how much weight can go in exactly which areas, and you need to make sure that over time, as your farm or garden develops and changes, you need to make sure that you're referring back to the structural engineer's report to make sure that you're not exceeding the loads in areas of the roof that you shouldn't be exceeding those loads, because that can be very dangerous.
In particular, you mentioned rain barrels, I guess, because they could deliberately collect what it turns out is a fairly heavy substance called water.
That's right. And a rain barrel is a great example of what's called a point load, where
yes,
you have a lot of weight that's concentrated in a very small area.
Well, you divide by size, these roof farms or garden farms, I guess it is. And each chapter you go through checklists so that people know what they have to check on before launching into this project, which I think has to be so useful as a manual to people contemplating this.
Right. That was a clever little thing that I worked out, sort of informed by a workbook or a how to kind of do it yourself manual. So there's parts of the book that definitely allude to that. Other parts are more sort of illustrative case studies.
And then you do interviews with the people involved, the principals involved.
That's right. There are key interviews throughout the book in all the different sections that highlight conversations with the industry leaders. And that's everyone from rooftop farmers and rooftop gardeners to CEOs of these rooftop farms and landscape architects and volunteer coordinators. So there's all these other people who are involved. It's not just the growers, but it's everyone from the business end of things, the business representatives, to the people who are eating the food and everyone in between.
You also give a history of this. And it turns out that this is not a new phenomenon, that you could turn all the way back to Babylon. I guess you're talking about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, right?
Exactly.
Who
I know it's wild. There are some historians who believe that the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is in current-day Iraq, was the first example of rooftop agriculture. And this is a long time ago. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were around about 600 BCE. And so these historians believe that the terraced roofs of this building were used to produce not only fruits and vegetables, but also fish.
Right.
Oh, no kidding. Okay. Yeah, I understand. Now, that reminds me of the Alhambra in Granada. They had a very sophisticated system of canals carrying water all the way through that property. But did they use it for food, or was it just...
No, it was. I think it was...
Just to feed all the fountains, because they like fountains.
Well, yeah, water was an aesthetic issue for them.
That's right. I think they did have fish, if I'm not mistaken, in one or two of those pools, but
good.
Probably not for eating, just for pets, I guess.
Well, who would you advise to get a hold of this book? Just about, you said anybody...
Oh, yeah. The audience for this book is very large. It's everyone from home gardeners, people who are interested in urban agriculture, to architects and landscape architects, city planners, policymakers, anyone who might come across the idea of rooftop agriculture and needs a resource to look to. It's also a great academic book. So for any professors out there who touch upon urban agriculture, this is a great book for you.
Gives a new meaning to the phrase, eat up your greens, doesn't it?
Or your goats.
Or your goats, yeah.
Or chickens or rabbits or whatever. Well, I just found it absolutely so filled with information that we've just touched the surface of what you can get out of this book. I know that it's a growing issue, and so I hope that... I didn't mean growing that way, did I?
Pun intended.
But I really do believe more and more that people are turning to this for a number of reasons, health being one, but safety, food safety being another. I love the whole concept, as long as we don't have the roofs caving in.
Now, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working with a client right now, and I should say that in my day job, I design green roofs. So I design usually ornamental vegetated roofs, but we're starting to incorporate rooftop agriculture into our business. So I have one client right now who is a public school in South Philadelphia, and we just completed the first phase of our crowdfunding campaign in order to raise money to eventually build a rooftop farm on top of the school.
That's great.
It's a really great project. I'm very excited about. I have another client in Brooklyn, and we're working together on a rooftop farm there. And people are interested in reading my book. There's a lot of information in there. There's also a lot of information on my website, which is more current because I update it all the time with different initiatives that are going on around the country. And my website is eatupag.com.
Tell me, eat?
It's E-A-T-U-P.
Yeah.
A-G. Okay. .com. So eatupag.com.
Great. I'm going there right now.
Wonderful.
I'm looking for the chapter that says how it can have a garden on a steeply pitched roof. The answer to that is probably no.
Yeah, I guess not.
But thank you.
You have to do it very carefully.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you every success, and this book is absolutely a great contribution.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I'm going to have Anne pronounce our next guest's name.
Oh, I wondered what you were doing.
I have to do that.
Manit Chauhan. And I must say that you're in for a treat, because she has such a fresh, interesting, adventurous approach to flavor. So when she's talking about the flavors of her world, you're going to want to make them the flavors of your world.
And she's picking on you wherever you are, whether you're in France or whether you're in England or whether you're in other parts of the world. She's going to bring some spice into your life, no doubt. So let's hear it from
Manit Chauhan. Manit Chauhan, I get exhausted reading just your bio. It would be shorter to say what you don't do. You're a chef, a CIA graduate on top of all that, top honors. You do television. You're a judge on Chopped, one of the hottest programs currently running. You're developing a spice line. You've just written this wonderful cookbook called Flavors of My World. And then you are opening a restaurant in Nashville, and you're a new mother. Why are you not totally wiped out and exhausted?
Who says I'm not? I completely am. But that's the fun of it.
Now, you were born in India.
Yes.
And raised in India?
Yes.
And then you came to the U.S. and graduated from the CIA. Culinary Institute of America. But when you're doing this book now, Flavors of My World, what it's subtitled is Culinary Tour Through 25 Countries. And what it is you've selected what you think are the 25 most significant cuisines in the world, and then where did you go from that? First of all, how did you select them?
So to me, food is like life. It's about constant evolution. And this is something that all of us do at home. We take a dish that we really, really love. And when we are cooking it at home, we put our own twist to it. We put our own signature to it. And our signature really is based on what we have grown up with. And I have grown up with Indian food. So these 25 countries are countries either which I have visited or people close to me have visited, and I have lived or tasted the food vicariously through them, or one or two dishes which have over the years when I have been reading about those dishes or those countries that they have stuck in my memory. So that's how I came up with this collection of 25 different countries.
Let's just give listeners an idea. Of course, there's France, right?
Right.
And there's Greece.
Completely.
There's the UK, England. What are some of the other countries? Well, China is not a surprise. Peru is right on trend, right?
Right.
I mean, that's supposed to be the new hot cuisine, right?
Exactly. But off the beaten, like things like Ethiopia.
Yeah,
you know?
That one I was looking at, wondering. I know that Ethiopian cuisine is really extraordinary, but how did you put it in the top 25?
You know, the first time that I had Ethiopian food was actually in Chicago. I was gone out with my sister and brother-in-law, and when I was tasting the food, there were so many spices and flavors which were so reminiscent of Indian cuisine and Indian food.
Uh-huh.
But the way they were treated were completely different. So it was a very, you know, it was something familiar. It jogged my memory in terms of spices. I'm like, I taste cardamom. I taste cinnamon. I taste cloves. These are such Indian spices.
Right.
But the way they were utilized were completely different. So this, the doro wat, which is it's a traditional chicken Ethiopian dish, was something which I always loved. And when I was coming up with this book, I'm like, of course, this dish has to find a place in the book.
Now, of the 25, you did one recipe for each of those countries, correct?
Two. One food recipe and one drink recipe.
Yes,
okay.
It's two.
Got it.
Some of them, I mean, most of them I'm not startled by. I was a little startled to see Jamaica.
Right.
Do you think that's kind of unusual to be in the top 25 cuisines of the world?
These are the top 25 cuisines for me. And I think because ackee and saltfish is such a staple in Jamaica, and a lot of the cuisine in Jamaica and the Caribbean has been influenced by Indian immigrants over the years. So again, this was another thing which was, ackee is such an unusual ingredient. When you taste it, or it looks like scrambled eggs.
Uh-huh.
And saltfish, again, it's such a bold flavor. So, like, you know, when and when my husband had gone to Jamaica, and he used to sing praises of this dish. Because of that, I had tried it once, and I'm like, this is really delicious. So it was just a matter of putting my own twist to it. And Vindaloo spice blend is so very robust. It's very strong in itself. And that stands up to the strong flavor of the salt fish. So it was just a beautiful natural marriage.
Now, staying on the subject of fish, of course, the dish you chose to represent my native land is fish and chips, which seems a rather mundane choice when you first sort of go at it, sort of like Manit meets Long John Silver's. So what did you do? You did something very different. You did something quite spicy with that too.
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting when you think about England and you think about a national dish. I mean, chicken tikka masala now literally has become the national dish of England. And it is so interesting how well Indian food has been welcomed into the entire English cuisine as such. But when you think about English cuisine, it's fish and chips. I mean, that's what you know, some fresh fish and beautifully fried chips. I mean, it's a simple, it's delicious, if done well. So I really wanted to take it and elevate it to another level, and that was by adding some spice to it. So I batter frying it in chickpea flour and a little bit of ginger garlic and a little bit of ajwain, which is carom seeds. It just gives it another level and depth of flavor and spices. And, of course, the potato chips. They have some ground cumin and chilies and mango powder, and you can just have a whole bowl of that with a nice tall glass of beer. So it's just delicious.
Now, just to show that you have no respect for anything sacred, your drink for Ireland is something to do with Guinness?
Exactly.
Go ahead. Explain yourself.
So it is called, it is Guinness Kokum. So basically, Guinness, as it is, I know, it's sacrilege with what I have done, but till the time you don't try it, you don't understand the beauty of this really tart kokum fruit that we have married along with Guinness. Now, kokum is almost, it's a flower that you get in southern India. It's almost like tamarind, so it's got this tart flavor to it, and it is a lovely, robust flavor. So it goes beautifully with almost the caramel robust flavor of the Guinness. So yeah, it's I know it's sacrilege. Delicious.
Now, have you ever stood in a bar in Dublin and ordered one?
No.
No.
I definitely haven't.
You better
be
careful.
But it's definitely on my to-do list. I'll go to Ireland and I'm like, can I have a Coke and Guinness, please?
Well, while you're at it, you can try to get a lassie in Russia.
Why not?
I thought that was hysterical. Siberian blueberry lassie.
Exactly. You know, and it's interesting because my fascination with Russia really started when my dad, I think this was in 1980 when he went to Russia, and he came back with these stories about Russia, about the food, and a lot of fairy tale books, which I literally grew up on, you know.
Russian fairy tales?
Yeah, Russian fairy tales, and it was interesting because he got those back. And I always was very fascinated with the Tsars. On the top of my list of the places to go is actually Moscow. I really want to see the Kremlin and visit St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I hear St. Petersburg, is really something.
I know. So that is definitely on top of my list. But, you know, and then he would tell us these stories. And over the years, as I would hear these stories, and of course, vodka is such a, you know, is as Russian as it gets. Lassi is as Indian as it gets. And just getting these two different ingredients together, it just worked so beautifully. We tried a lot of different recipes. And there were things which had been done. Like vodka is, I think, at the present moment, one of the most popular liquors out there.
Oh, yeah.
And there were so many different things which were done. And one day I was just sipping lassi. I'm like, okay, when I think about an Indian drink, I think of lassi. And when I think about Russia, I think of vodka. So
yeah, combine.
There went the bygone. So So this just worked out beautifully.
Now, tell us about this spice. Well, there are three things I want to ask you. You can pick what order. I want to know about this spice line you're coming out with. I'm assuming it's a blend. I'm not sure, but you have to tell me about that. I want to know about what it's like behind the scenes at Chopped, because you certainly have a fascinating cast. And then thirdly, why in the world did you decide, did you choose Nashville as the site for your new restaurant?
Okay, fantastic. So with the spice line, let's start with the spice line. You know what? Over the years, since the time I came to America, as soon as I landed, I had just come from India. I was going to school at the CIA, and I decided to take my friends, and I was the only Indian on campus for the better part of my time at the CIA.
And one of very few women also, probably.
Yes, yes. So I was like, Indian food, not many people know about it. So I decided to take my friends to an Indian restaurant. And I went over there and I tasted the food and I'm like, this is not the beautiful Indian food that I've grown up with. Over the years, I thought that a lot of these places, Indian cuisine was somewhere along the line lost in translation. And so I became very passionate about the fact that I wanted to expose the beauty of Indian food to the masses over here. And the book is one of the first few steps. It is very subtly using Indian ingredients and Indian spices in dishes that people are familiar with and elevating it to another level and seeing the beauty and tasting the beautiful nuances of spices that can carry. And the spice line is on the same lines. It is using Indian spices and ingredients and coming up with four different blends. So we have something which is called a Burger Madness. And Burger Madness is a spice blend that you can add in ground beef, ground chicken, turkey. Again, use it in whatever way you want.
But it's fresh? I mean, it's not fresh. It's a blend?
Exactly. It's a blend of different spices. And, you know, but we are using Indian spices like amchur, which is dried mango powder, or fenugreek leaves, which is, again, very traditional Indian. And then we have another spice blend, which is called rescue spice, which will, literally it's a spice blend which will rescue any dish. Or we have another spice blend, which is called brown sugar and spice rub down.
Yes, I've read about that one.
Yeah, that has tamarind in it, so it's tamarind and mustard, so very delicious. And then, of course, the last one, which we really love the name, is called the chicken gone wild. So it is, again, a spice blend that you can add on chicken wings, you can add on whole chicken roast, you can add on just chicken breast. So, again, what I would love people to do is experiment with these spices. You can use it on chicken, but hey, go ahead and try it on turkey, try it on pork. So it is a starter kit to get their feet wet with Indian spices.
Okay, now what about your restaurant? What's it going to be called? What's the concept and why in Nashville?
Okay, so the name is still under, we're still working on the name, but the concept is going to be a gastropub and a microbrewery, Indian inspired. So we are going to have small plates of kebabs or Indian inspired small plates, and the beers, we are working with brewers who are going to come up with beers with Indian spices like cardamom flavor, saffron. So it's going to be a really fun and a hip place. And why Nashville? Because my partners, first of all, are from Nashville.
Okay.
The largest convention center in the South is opening in Nashville in fall. And over the last 1 year, a lot of culinary attention has been given to Nashville. There are some chefs moving, big-name chefs moving
Sean
to Nashville.
Sean Brock just opened
house. Exactly.
Yeah.
And we also have...
Gillespie, you know, too, right?
Exactly. And New York Times actually covered Nashville a couple of times last year. So it's a very exciting place. And then overall, people are so nice in Nashville. So it's just a really nice place to go. And I opened my first restaurant over there.
Wow, that's good. Now, what you mentioned about beer, and in the book, maybe some press materials I read where people are always wondering what to drink with Indian food. And the best thing to drink with Indian food is beer. And that's what I always thought, but we were just at a wonderful Indian restaurant in London, and we were introduced for the first time to Indian wines, and they're quite good.
Yes, Indian vines have come a long way. I remember when I was in school, we had gone to one of the vineyards and we were like tasting the wines and we were like, okay,
yeah, right.
This needs help. But that was 15 years back.
Oh, it's really good now.
It is. But, you know, that was one of the reasons why I thought about doing a microbrewery, because growing up, we never had a wine culture in India. Wine was, if you were thinking of having something to drink, it was always beer. And then, of course, the entire IPA came along because of the Indian weather. So it just seemed like a very natural segue into when you're thinking of food and wine pairings, it is food and beer pairings.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun.
Well, you're going to have fun in Nashville.
Now, what's the target for opening?
End of the year.
Okay. Well, we've added Nashville along with Austin on our list for a while now. So,
all we have to do is stir ourselves to get there.
Yeah. Last question is it as much fun behind the scenes of Chopped as it looks?
No, actually, it's not. It's a lot more fun. It is amazing. The entire, it's a Chopped family, and everybody is as funny as the next person. I mean, when I go over there on the sets, the entire day I am just laughing. And it's amazing. It's sitting with your contemporaries who have done very well in this entire industry, learning from them, learning from the entire, you know, the contestants also who come on and who are competing. But in the end of the day, the camaraderie is incredible. And I mean, I love each and every moment being on the sets of Chopped. It's amazing.
Oh. Well, you must come back and talk to us again when your restaurant is open.
Definitely. And you must come and visit me in Nashville at the restaurant.
Oh, yeah. That's a good reason to go there.
And we'll wait till you're open.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
But Manit, there's so much to always talk to you about, but I think that we should at this point repeat the name of the book, because that's what we're selling right now.
Exactly.
And it's called Flavors of My World, a culinary tour through 25 countries, guided by Manit Chauhan. And thank you so much for taking the time out of this incredible schedule you manage to even talk to us.
Oh, it was entirely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, thanks, Manit.
And right after this message, we'll be back with Mediterranean cuisine, just like we've been doing Indian cuisine. And before that, things have grown on your roof. Can't say you don't get diversity here at On the Menu Radio.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and everyone knows we should be eating a Mediterranean diet because it's proved to be much healthier. But just exactly what is it? And here we have Lynn Giuliati from the Culinary Institute telling us about
not only that it's healthy, in fact,
but she's helping us define it and helping us make it.
And helping us make sure it tastes good.
Exactly.
Which is, after all, the most important thing.
Right. So here's Lynn. Mediterranean cooking is supposed to be hot right now, but as far as I'm concerned, it's always hot. And that's exactly what the author of this latest book, Lynn Giuliati, has to say about it. Lynn is a professor at the Culinary Institute of America. And Lynn, you said that people kept encouraging you to write a book for years before you, but you sure bit off a chunk of it trying to cover Mediterranean cuisine.
Yeah, you know, it was quite a task. Leah had the CIA behind me, and it's really hard to describe the Mediterranean in one book. So
yeah.
this is just a little slice of the Mediterranean. You could study it for years. There's so many countries and so many regions in each country. It's mind-boggling.
But we've talked to people before, and they've said that there is a common thread, even though these countries are politically different and socially different. They do share a sort of a toolkit of basic ingredients which happen to grow in the region or which can be caught, fished for in the region.
Well, I think because all the countries that surround the Mediterranean Sea are on the sea, the climate is arid. I think there's a Mediterranean trinity that's wheat, grapes, and olives. So the main cooking fat of choice, of course, is olive oil, which is really good for you and tastes really good. Wheat in the form of, well, lots of different forms. You know, durum, semolina, bulgur wheat.
Couscous, I guess, right?
And, yeah, of course, couscous is pasta.
But it's made from a grain.
It's technically a pasta, but it's made from a grain.
It's made from wheat.
That's true, but everybody calls it a grain. It's not a grain.
I didn't say it was a grain.
No, it's not. It's not a grain proper, but it's made from a grain.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Like that stuff we used to call tadpoles.
Tadpoles?
What do they call that? It's like rice. He used to use it to make rice pudding. Semolina. Huh. Not semolina.
Tapioca. I love tadpoles.
I'm never going to be able to call it tapioca without remembering that.
That's what we used to call it. That's what we used to call it when my mother made it.
You put one of the really great things about this cookbook is you put this whole subject of cuisine, Mediterranean cuisine, into a context so that people do get the big picture, even though, you know, I'm sure there are lots of things you want to write in addition to what you already wrote. But how did you organize it? You didn't organize it by country, which you would think.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't actually want to organize it by country. The book is like a big, think of it as a big pot, and I just took a lot of Mediterranean ingredients and threw them in the pot and stirred. So I've mixed and matched things, and I just organized it as I would any other cookbook into soups and then appetizers, grains, vegetables, poultry and meat, fish, and then breads and cheeses and desserts, because I just took the flavors of the Mediterranean, and while there are a lot of traditional dishes in the book, there are some very non-traditional dishes that include some ingredients from the Mediterranean, so they have a Mediterranean feel to them.
Yeah, I've never heard of artichoke and lavender soup, for example.
No, it's delicious.
Sounds good.
Is that
a traditional soup?
No, not per se, but it's traditional ingredients.
Yeah, you sort of made them up, right? You made up your own recipe.
Oh, yeah, most of these recipes are, if they're not the recipes that we use in the curriculum at school, they're my own recipe.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when the curriculum was initiated at the CIA.
The Mediterranean.
Yeah.
I think it's been in place for at least, I want to say 15 years or so.
Okay, so then it's the other one, the French culinary, that introduced the Mediterranean component more recently than that, huh?
Oh, well, ours is sort of more morphed from cuisines of Europe and the Mediterranean into cuisines of the Mediterranean. We used to include Eastern Europe in the course, but, you know, it's too much information. So luckily for me, they focused on Mediterranean.
When you say luckily for you, that just happened to be something you liked?
Yes. Well, I had a Mediterranean restaurant in Atlanta, and so when I got to work here, I was teaching the skills classes, but I definitely had my eye on teaching the Mediterranean class. And finally, I got into the curriculum group, and now I'm firmly implanted.
You know, some of these recipes, if you're not really super familiar with these cuisines, you'd view them as authentic. You wouldn't realize, you know, how creatively you've assembled them. Like this one, capellini with clams, botarga, and preserved Meyer lemons.
Yeah, that's a combination of just different ingredients that, although they might not be traditionally seen on a table here or there, they go really well together.
These recipes look delicious. And I might point out that the book itself is very handsome. And anybody,
it is.
Yes, the photography is extraordinary.
Oh, well, Ben Fink is a wonderful photographer. He's awesome. I love him. Uh-huh. Very lucky to have him.
Does he do all the CIA stuff, or was this a special thing?
No, he's done a lot of their at-home books, and he's done the Pro Chef and the Garmage book and the Baking and Pastry book. He's our good go-to guy.
Now, you are not too proud to take ideas from other people about what to include either. I noticed that our good old friend Jose Andres had an influence on one of the recipes.
Sure, everybody. I take influence from everybody, and imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. Some old chefs of mine, my grandmother, my mother, borrowed things from everybody.
Did you see the Jose Andres inspired recipe?
Which one is that?
It's squid, but it's not cleaned.
What is it?
Yeah, talking about the squid.
Yeah, the squid. And I guess they don't clean the ink sac out.
What do they do?
They just cook it. You eat it.
Yeah.
So it's in tintu.
Yeah, but in the United States, you have to buy the ink separately.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's right. You do have to buy it separately. Just like
you do.
Yeah, I mean, like a pork roast. Peter was so shocked when, because he's English, you know, he was shocked that you don't get crackling, that you can't sell pork with the fat layer still attached.
You can. You have to go to a very specialized market.
Well, they tie it on. I mean,
I think chefs like Sean Brock and people like that, I think that they have small farm sources that they can get pork that way. It's just that the packing houses don't do it that way. The packing houses take the skin off and throw it away.
Oh, I thought was
or make it into dog food or something.
I thought it was the inspectors did that.
What a waste, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the advantages to your doing this book like that is you make some really interesting contrasts dish to dish. I mean, Peter was talking about the squid with caramelized onions from Jose, but a page before that was Galician octopus fair style, which I didn't know about. Bouillabaisse is just before that. So you see all these relationships from dish to dish.
Yeah, it has a flow. You know, if you've been in the Mediterranean, you see the common ingredients, and you realize there is a method to my madness.
Yes, I know. I read in some of the press materials that you also had the added task of making these doable in the home kitchen, part of that whole concept of these books, right?
Yes, we actually filmed I'd say 98% of the food photography that we did was filmed in my home, so it's definitely... definitely doable in a home kitchen.
And I'd like to know who sits around doing certain Indian sheet music.
Crazy people. I have a friend whose uncle makes strudel frequently at home.
I was going to say it's the same people who make their own phyllo.
No, it's the same. Yeah, it's the same thing, and it's kind of fun. I think if you have a Saturday afternoon and you really like to cook, it's a new hobby that I think people are coming back to.
Right. Yeah.
I'd rather cook than watch TV.
Everyone keeps saying people are watching all the cooking shows on TV and not cooking at all.
I know. Well, they should be cooking, not watching. Cook more, watch less.
So anyhow, now you don't have a CD. Or DVD component to this? Like, what's the big culinary book, the Pro Chef series?
No, there's no CD component to this, but that's a good idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, people really like those.
I know. That would be a lot of fun to have some live cooking classes and a CD in the book.
Yeah.
I've thought about putting some free cooking classes on YouTube, something I might do. I have to check and term allowed to do that. I'm not sure.
Because there are all these restrictions now.
Check with the powers that be, right?
Exactly.
I don't want to be
too much of an outlaw, you know.
You've now done Mediterranean cuisine. What cuisine are you going to do next? You can't stop writing books, after all.
I would like to continue writing. I'm not sure. It really depends on what they would like me to write, because I'm working with the CIA. I just go to the publishing company and say, what would you like me to write? It's fun writing a cookbook. So okay.
I did one for a chef, and I said never again would I ever do another one. I thought it was a nightmare. I really did. I mean, so many details.
Oh, it is. It's very detail-oriented, but I really liked it. It sort of took me out of the classroom and gave me something else to do that was, I don't know, it was a lot of fun for me, and I don't mind all those details.
We're certainly going to enjoy cooking this. I see Anne's open at a page.
I want this right now.
Which is vinegar chicken with celery root.
You're right.
Oh, that's delicious. We're making that this evening in class.
I want it.
Come on over. We're making it with, instead of the celery root, instead of the chicken, we're making it with duck confit.
Oh, that's nice, too.
Really, really good. At 5:30, come on down.
Well, it's a little far. If we had our own Learjet, we'd be able to make it.
And now some of this, of course, like the Florentine-style steak, you can't get that in the U.S., period.
No, you can't get it in the U.S., but... You know, I think do it with a porterhouse, a good quality porterhouse from a really good butcher, not from.
You can come really close. I mean,
yeah.
The cut is very like what we used to call a cowboy steak.
But
you remember when we got the super balsamic vinegar and we needed some recipes to go along with it?
Right. From my article. Yeah.
So I got my 25-year-old balsamic and I got on the bus. I headed downtown to the Capitol Grill where the chef had promised that he would conjure up something using 25-year-old balsamic and some steaks that he just happened to have. So uh-huh. as soon as I got there, I was ushered into the kitchen. He threw the steak on the grill, cooked it just to the right degree of doneness, added a little balsamic at the last minute just to give it the extra flavor, and then said, would you like to do another one?
I got some too.
30 minutes later, I was on my way home on the bus carrying two Bistecca Fiorentino Capital Grill style.
That sounds delicious. I have an idea for the weekend now.
There you go.
And we don't forget, you have a nice soft shell crab with lemon polenta in here too.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You've given us
a lot
of food for thought. Yeah, you're getting hungry. Anne's getting hungry.
I had leftover fish for lunch.
Yeah, some leftover lentils.
And leftover lentils.
There you go. It's exciting.
I know you can do something with that. That sounds good.
Well, we're having...
I know, I ate it. I ate it at lunch.
The good thing is
that I know that when I open the book and I start getting hungry, I think I did a good job.
Oh, you did. I mean, these recipes are really inspirational. Rabbit braised with lavender and honey. I mean, what about that? You
that
like all of these. You're going to be doing a lot of cooking, Lynn.
Start at the beginning and cook your way to the end.
Okay. Well, again, it's Lynn Giuliati, and it's Mediterranean Cooking, and it's sponsored by the Culinary Institute of America, so it has to be good. And it looks to me like they're really inspirational and exciting. Not a boring recipe in the whole book. Lynn, thanks for coming on.
So much, Anne.
Yeah, it's great.
and thank you, Anne. Have a good dinner
tonight, too, a class and demo tonight.
We will. And thank you so much for having me, Anne and Peter. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that's good to talk to you. Thanks, Lynn.
Nice
bye-bye.
Nice to talk to you, too. Bye-bye.
And we have an interesting short segment for you right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Who knew that everybody's favorite snack, kettle potato chips, were invented and developed in Hawaii?
But, Rabbit, I don't think this is altogether clear. Now, I mean,
no, it's not altogether clear to me either, but that's...
Jeff, our next guest, is a really good sport because we not only got Tim's Cascade Snacks confused with the current owner of Pinnacle Foods, we got the fact that we thought he was making these kettle chips in Hawaii, and he wasn't even in Hawaii, and we don't know who invented them. But let's just listen to him give a plausible version.
Trust me, we are confusing you, and Tim will be. Tim, is it?
Jeff.
Jeff will be doing the opposite. He will be making it all very clear.
Oh, dear.
This is going to be an interesting interview because we're really entirely sure why we're conducting it. Nor is our guest, whose name is, sweetheart?
Jeff Lightlider,
who's calling us all the way from Hawaii. They actually have telephones over there. You didn't know that, people, did you? This is the time of the year when Anne goes out into the world of foods, prepared foods, fresh foods, all
specialty
those kinds
food.
Of things, specialty food, and looks for fascinating new products that... we've never seen or heard of before, and this is where Hawaiian kettle chips come in. So,
except that actually the company and the products are not going to be at the Fancy Food Show, but anyhow, they were good. We liked them.
And they're Hawaiian kettle potato chips, but they're made in the state of Washington?
That's correct.
Okay, Jeff, tell us a really good story now.
Okay. Well, the really good story is that these Hawaiian kettle-style potato chips that we create here in Washington are really an emulation of the old Hawaiian Polynesian cooking method, that when the trade winds would come in during the afternoon and calm and cool the oil down. This is really kind of creates that texture, that setup, and that crunchy potato chip that you would find originally in Hawaii. And the brand actually did come from Hawaii originally. So we're now the proud owners, along with Pinnacle Foods, to make those wonderful same recipe, same high quality right here in Washington, and be able to send it anywhere in the United States that we need to go.
So some of the kettle chip business originates, in fact, from the temperature and the weather in Hawaii.
That's correct.
And then other parts of the country, I guess, and other parts of the world caught on to the fact that this was a hell of a good way of making potato chips, so they started making kettle chips, too.
The kettle-style potato chips, that's correct.
And nobody bothered to patent it, I guess, right?
Well, you know, it's like turning the clock back, you know, a number of years and doing it the old-fashioned way before a lot of technology caught up with the rest of the world. So we still do it the old-fashioned way.
Okay, so your secret is traditional.
Yes.
Not cutting any corners, any of that kind of stuff.
No, we do it in very small batch. We do it every day.
Now, it's now a part of Pinnacle Foods, but in fact, Jeff had a partner starting this company called Tim's Cascade Snacks, which was in, what year did you say, Jeff?
Back in 1986, Tim Kennedy was the founder of Tim's Cascade Snacks, and I was lucky enough to be there on the ground floor from day one and help build the company from there. So today we are owned by Pinnacle Foods, which is located out of New Jersey, but we still have the same great products we've always done.
And the manufacturing facility is where? You said it's in the state of Washington?
It is. It's just south of Seattle in a little town called Algona, Washington.
There you go.
Is that because there are lots of potatoes there?
There are potatoes in Washington, and lots of them, so we're fortunate there, too.
Now, the seasonings are rather special, aren't they?
Yes. They're typically, on the Hawaiian kettle-style line, it's very bold and, much different than the rest of the world. We were fortunate to have one of the first sweet Maui onion recipes out there, you know, years ago, and since then a lot of people have tried to copy it, but haven't quite figured out all the magic behind that. But we have our new one out too, which is, as we were talking before, the cracked pepper and sea salt flavor. It's a very popular gourmet style flavor right now.
Now we hope it's Hawaiian sea salt.
It is sea salt, and it is from the sea.
But it's not from Hawaii.
I can't verify that, but
you can't. Okay, I mean it could be, right?
It could be.
Well, how many flavors do you have of these Hawaiian chips?
Well, we have the original, which is just the lightly sea salted. We have the luau barbecue, which is a spicy, sweet barbecue, and then we have the world famous sweet Maui onion in the purple bag, and then we have wasabi, which is for those horseradish lovers, a great one too. And
yeah, I never got one of those. Yeah.
Have you had one of those yet?
Yeah, I didn't have one of those.
Oh, those are wonderful. And then of course our sea salt cracked peppercorn.
Right, that's what I have.
Now you also make. Do they also make popcorn?
Yes, you make Aaron's popcorn too.
That's right. We produce the Aaron's popcorn right here in the same facility, and we do it every day in very small batches, the Aaron's all-natural popcorn line.
Uh-huh.
Now, what's availability like across the United States or across the world for that matter?
Well, the Aaron's actually is only available currently in the western United States. We do a fairly good business in Alaska and a little bit in Hawaii as well. But we're looking to expand that line, and it's a very popular, it's all natural, you know, and our latest rollout of white cheddar and jalapeno flavor is actually gluten-free and, you know, lots of good attributes for those folks looking for a better-for-you snack.
Right, and you also do onion rings?
We do. We do the under the Hawaiian label as well. We do a great onion ring, and we've got it in two flavors right now, the luau barbecue and the sweet Maui onion.
Now, how do people find out where they can get some?
Well, you can go to our website directly. You can go to pinnaclefoods.com, or you can go to timschips.com.
And that's no punctuation in either one of those except the period before the com.
That's correct.
Well, you're certainly in the right business, Jeff. I mean, the snack food, probably the only thing that's growing larger or faster rather than snack food is gluten-free. And if you combine the two of them, as you seem to be doing, you're really on the fast track for success in this country, huh?
Yeah, we We think we have the right magic in the product lines and the ideas that we're adding to our portfolio all the time with Pinnacle Foods' help.
Right. Well, they make great. A lot of things.
Here's a suggestion for you.
And the okay.
Potato growing company actually did this.
Oh.
An English potato growing company. They started out obviously growing potatoes, and then they decided that there was a use for them called making potato chips. So they did. And
okay.
they actually won best product at the Fancy Food
yeah,
Show
well,
in New York about 5 or 6 years ago. But then the next time we went to the show, we saw them selling vodka because they realized that they got a lot of leftover bits of potato after making the potato chips. So then they decided, well, if they had all these leftover potatoes, they might as well make vodka.
You know, that sounds like a wonderful idea to me. I think we'd have to just go figure out what kind of new license we'd have to get.
Well, you can certainly, it's easy, relatively easy to get licenses for a distillery in the states of Washington and Oregon.
Yeah, both of them.
Probably in Hawaii, too, for that matter. So
we'll have to look into that one.
Great. Well, if you decide to do that, give us a shout, let us know, and we'll have you on again, and we'll let you tell more of the story to our listeners. In the meantime, I'm going to go down and get some popcorn, because it's midway between lunch and dinner, and I'm hungry.
I think
there you go.
We wiped out the chips, I think.
Yeah, we wiped out.
I think so.
And we wiped out the chips really fast.
Right. Jeff, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
You too. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, whatever. I happen to like Hawaiian kettle chips, and I like a whole bunch of other things, and I'm already sampling stuff. Some of you actually may already be in New York City at the Summer Fancy Food Show, and we're sampling all these. I mean, it's just so many wonderful foods. I don't know where to start. But rest assured that you can snack your way and eat your way through this show. You'll be able to read a roundup of it on, I'm going to be writing an article for the review. But then it will be posted on our website so you can listen. And we're going to have ongoing interviews with some of these producers. Most of these producers have really interesting backgrounds, as many times not even vaguely associated with food.
It's almost as interesting as the mystery of where comes the trail of jalapeno. what do they call it stuff you like so much? Popcorn. Jalapeno popcorn. There's a trail of little bits around our house. It's true. I know it's true. So Anne must be enjoying them, so you will too. And I think we mentioned those.
I've eaten all the seaweed.
She's eaten everything. She's snacking in hog heaven. Anyway, yes. In the meantime, we'll be back with you again, same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.